It's the hashtag STRask Podcast. I'm Amy Hall.
That it is.
And this is Greg Kokel.
Hey.
All right. So this first question comes from Franklin Abelt. Mm-hmm. In Mark chapter 11, what is the purpose of Jesus cursing the fig tree? It seems out of character, and I can't understand its meaning. I'm sure it's symbolic of something.
Yeah, it probably is symbolic, and you may have more to say about this than I do, Amy, but it is, there is a mysterious element here for me as well. What happens in Mark 11, I think there's a parallel passage in Matthew, is that Jesus sees, verse 13 here, at a distance, a fig tree in leaf. He went to see if perhaps he would find anything on it, and when he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. Okay, so far so good. And then Jesus said, may no one ever eat fruit from you again. And his disciples were listening. And then it goes on. I mean, the circumstances change here. What follows, though, may be significant. And the reason I say this is that sometimes writers will, ancient writers, particularly gospel writers here, will gather anecdotes together and put them in a certain order to make a point. And so not everything in Mark we know is in proper order. Papias made a comment about that, one of the church fathers, that Mark had written a disorderly kind of account where Luke then puts a lot of things in order, all right? And what comes next, though, may be related. Then they came to Jerusalem, and he, Jesus, entered the temple and began to drive out those who were buying and selling in the temple and overturning the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who were selling doves. So it almost looks like the way this is situated here in the account. And remember, there are no verses in the original, and there are no subheadings. And subheadings often cause a problem because there is one right here. He said to the may no one ever eat fruit from you again, and then in the subheading, Jesus drives money changers from the table, which isolates what comes before from what follows. And if you're reading without those headings, it would flow directly into the problem with the money changers, Jesus cleansing the temple, which may suggest on the fig tree, he found nothing but leaves, no fruit. And when he comes to Jerusalem and to the temple, he finds nothing but leaves, no fruit. Same idea. For some of us, that may seem far-fetched, some listening, but this is the way things were organized a lot of times in the Gospels and in ancient writing. There's a theological point that's being made here. The thing that's a mystery to me is Jesus is angry even though it was not the season for figs. That's the part that I don't make sense of, and it seems a little odd probably to other readers. But you've done some thinking about this, Amy.
Yeah, so this is a common thing that atheists will bring up to asking about this passage. So a while back, I started paying attention as I was reading through the Bible and came across a couple of passages that I think shed light on this, because I do agree with you. I think it's a theological point that's being made here, and I think they would have recognized it. Hmm. So the first one is Jeremiah 8, and about halfway through the chapter, he's talking about, let's see, I'll start in verse 8. How can you say, we are wise and the law of the Lord is with us, but behold, the lying pen of the scribes has made it into a lie. The wise men are put to shame. They are dismayed and caught. Behold, they have rejected the word of the Lord. And what kind of wisdom do they have? Then a few verses later, he says, I will surely snatch them away, declares the Lord. There will be no grapes on the vine and no figs on the fig tree, and the leaf will wither, and what I have given them will pass away. So here's an idea of them rejecting the word of the Lord and God punishing them by withering the leaf of their fig tree.
So but the lack of fruit is in virtue of their godlessness, right?
Right.
And that is right. That is being judged in this circumstance, right?
So here's another passage from Micah 7. Woe is me, for I am like the fruit pickers, like the grape gatherers. There is not a cluster of grapes to eat or a first ripe fig, which I crave. The godly person has perished from the land, and there is no upright person mm-hmm. among men. So here's this idea of the first ripe figs being the godly people. There are no godly people in the land. And the withering, the leaves of the fig tree, because there are no godly people and they've rejected the word of the Lord. So these mm-hmm. are images that they would have had in their mind from the prophets.
Mm-hmm.
So now we go over to, let's look at it in Matthew.
The parallel passage.
The parallel passage in Matthew. And you're right about the passages around it, because right after the fig tree section, he tells the parable of the two sons, where God tells, or the father tells them both to go out. One doesn't, says no, but then he goes, and then one says yes, and then he doesn't.
Right.
So his point, again, is to the, he's making points to Pharisees here where they weren't following the word of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And then right at the end, then he tells the parable of the landowner, where they send, the landowner sends people to collect the fruit of the vineyard.
Right, right.
And then they
beat
they kill
them up,
yeah.
And they kill them, and then he sends his son, and they kill the son.
Right. So then he gets to the end of that, verse 43, therefore I say to you, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a people producing the fruit of it.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this is in the same section about fruit not being produced, about rejecting the word of the Lord, about not having the first ripe figs that he asked. So now the question is, why does he say it wasn't the time for figs? And then it seems like, well, that's just not fair.
Right. Yeah.
All right. Here, this is just speculation, but here are my thoughts on that.
Okay.
When you think about what the Pharisees were doing, they were following the rules, but they were not loving God. They were not giving to God their hearts. They were not responding to him. They were just following the rules. So I wonder if what Jesus was saying was, you know, if the Son of God comes to a fig tree, the fig tree gives figs,
mm-hmm.
right? But if the fig tree is like, but I'm following the rules, this is not the time for rules. Just like the Pharisees used to say, you don't heal on the Sabbath.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Don't heal on the Sabbath. That's the rule. And I think it could be a judgment on that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's just my thought.
It's a speculation
on
that. Yeah. At this point, but yeah, it's worthwhile. That was the part that always bothered me here, was not the season for figs. But yeah, you're breaking our rules. It's like, don't heal on the Sabbath.
Right.
Saturdays, the Sabbath. The Sabbath is not the day for healing. Go wait a day to heal that paralytic, something like that.
So they were swallowing a camel and straining out the gnat, right? So
I have a question, though.
What
would be the atheist's objection here? I can see how somebody would say, wow, that doesn't seem fair. Wow, I don't understand why that happened. And as a reader, I can sympathize with it, but I don't see how that's an argument against anything.
Well, you'll notice here in the question, and this is someone who faithfully sent us good questions,
uh-huh.
so I thank him for that. He says, it seems out of character.
Uh-huh.
So atheists will use this to disparage Jesus' character, uh-huh. which I'm not really sure what harm it does if you, if you wither a tree. I mean, it's a tree.
This is maybe another example of straining at a gnat and swallowing a camel. He withered that tree, and it didn't deserve it. That bad. I said, wait a minute. He withered the tree with a word. Does that tell you anything? With a word, he withered the tree.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
So.
And I think they would have been familiar with this idea of the withered fig tree, of the fig tree not producing figs because of a lack of godly people and rejecting the word of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And again, following these rules without the heart, you know, I desire compassion, not a sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
This is a frequent you know, repetitive idea inside
that we
the
see
Gospels.
In the text, right. Yeah. The it's interesting. It says here, his disciples were listening. Now, disciples were listening. If they think, if they thought that Jesus was doing some bad thing, they would have said something, it seems to me. I don't know, like a moral thing. Jesus did a lot of things they didn't understand, but I don't think the disciples understood this to be an immoral thing. Anyway, just a thought.
Okay, here is a question from Simon. In the Old Testament, it seems that women were treated as less than and were definitely background characters, even without apparent choice in matters such as who they married. And then he quotes Genesis 38:2, quote, he took her. Does God approve of this, or is it not how things are supposed to be?
Well, if the issue is who they married, then we're Westerners, right? And so we're really into love and choice and stuff like that. And so the idea that there would be an arranged marriage is anathema to a lot of Westerners. And so when we read about arranged marriages, we think, oh, my gosh, how could that happen? How could God approve? This is the tyranny of the present, I think. We're looking anachronistically back, importing a value system that wasn't part of that era. We watched The Nativity as a family the other night. It's my favorite movie during Christmas because it, I think, captures a wonderful aspect of the biblical account, and that is the struggle that Mary and Joseph had, given the fact that she was bearing this child through a virgin, through a supernatural conception. So in this movie, though, when she is betrothed to Joseph, she's out of sorts, and she tells her mother, why should I have to marry a man I don't love? And both my wife and I looked at each other like, oh, God, what a yawner. She would never have said that kind of thing because this is the way it worked that way. And it wasn't like everybody was saying, oh, this is awful. It's the way it worked. But we just have to put up with it because it's the way. No, it's the way that everything worked. And it, guess what? It worked. That's the way families were created. And it's still in many parts of the world. This is the case. When I was in India in 1992, the pastor's son wanted the mother to choose a wife for him. This is 1992. That was their culture, and he felt more comfortable with that. Now, by the way, notice if parents are choosing spouses for their children, they are probably going to choose from groups of people that are very much like them, which creates stability in a home. Okay? Same religious beliefs, same culture, same background, blah, 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 blah. Similarities. The more you don't want diversity in a marriage. Diversity causes instability. And so one of the reasons a lot of these marriages were stable is because the choices were good ones, and the expectation was marriage was to create a partnership and a family. Marriage wasn't something you did for love. Love came after the marriage, not before. Just like that famous song from... If I Were a Rich Man, what's that movie?
You know, Fiddler on the Roof.
Fiddler on the Roof, yeah. Do you love me? You know, for 40 years I had this and that and everything for you. You know, if that's not love, what is, kind of thing. Well, that's a different ethic from the West. But I'm not championing one over the other. I'm saying that sometimes we read details of an ancient culture in Scripture and we find it discomforting because our values are different. But if we impose our values on them, then we are placing them in a circumstance they're not in. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying it always was rosy and everything is wonderful and women were treated the way they should be treated, whatever. But I think what is being expressed here is a discomfort with something happening that is not consistent with a Western ideal. The discomfort is not theological. Does God approve of this? Why would he disapprove? Abraham went out and found a wife for his servant for his son Isaac, you know. Rebecca, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was standard. That was ordinary. Now, in that case, Rebecca had an opportunity to say aye or nay, and she was willing to say yes, but she couldn't be in love with this guy. She just met this guy.
Yeah, they did ask her, will you go with this
right.
man?
Right, they asked her, yeah. yes. And so she had a choice, but the choice wasn't tied to love. Well, I don't love him. She was making her, she was probably deciding, you know why? Because he was the one who whacked the bad guys at the well. He took care of her. He could protect her. He was courageous. He was a man's man. And she knew, well, this is a guy who's going to take care of me. Remember, didn't he chase the people away from the well?
I think it was his servant that went to see her. Maybe.
Oh, that's
maybe
right.
You're
it was
of
a servant.
Rachel.
Never mind. I'm getting my characters mixed up. But
there's a lot of people looking for wives in the Old Testament.
Yeah, a lot of people get whacked with staffs at the well too. So, anyway, you can forgive the confusion at this point. But the point I'm making is that she wasn't rebelling against the system. This is the way it was done.
Mm-hmm.
And my conclusion, by the way, from that is that people, there is no biblical way to choose a mate, strictly speaking. But the way that mates were chosen in the Old Testament, in the biblical times, was the way everybody else in the culture chose mates. It was the standard of the culture.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if the standard of the culture is not that way now, it's people make their own choices, well, then that's going to be fine as long as you stay committed to the choice that you make.
I have a few other things to say, because he asks, were women treated as less than, and were they, and then he says they were definitely background characters. My thought on that is women tend to be focused on micro issues, on smaller issues, on family, on relationships. So when you're looking at a book that's about a huge part of history and looking at people who are moving the bigger aspects of history along, mm-hmm. of course there will be more men involved in that. That doesn't mean that the Bible's saying that they're less than. It doesn't even mean they're background characters. There are some really important mm-hmm. female characters. How about Mary?
Yeah.
How about Rahab? You know, Rahab was in the line of Christ.
Right.
Ruth was in the line of Christ.
Right.
So we even have an entire book about Ruth and Naomi.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that book is not a big picture book because, again, it's about women. So mm-hmm. it's focused on a family. It's focused on a smaller group. And yet, what she did was so important to the birth of Christ hundreds of years later.
Mm-hmm.
So she was not a background character.
Right.
So I think there are plenty of women characters who play important roles in the story of redemption,
yeah.
in the entire thing. It's just that women usually are more interested and drawn to smaller...
The micro.
Yeah, the micro rather than the macro.
Well, I think that's a fair observation. There's some people listening that aren't going to like it. But this is a description, not a prescription. You're not saying this is the way it's always got to be. But this is the way it was back then. And I think it's a very good observation. I've just been reading through the book of Judges, and you had Deborah in there as a mm-hmm. judge, for example. Then you got Jael.
Mm-hmm.
And Jael was the one who drove the stake through the temple of the bad guy. Can't remember his name, you know. But here, this was, and she delivered his corpse. Here was a pretty hardy gal making a choice in favor of God's people. So I just use that as an example because there are lots of other individuals that seem to pop up
mm-hmm.
doing very brave, courageous things and having a significant impact in the big picture.
Like Abigail, who saved David's life.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of times people make this accusation. They're actually not that familiar with the Old Testament. But there are a lot of women in the Old Testament and in the New Testament where Paul over and over says... mentions women that are fellow workers in the gospel with
right,
him
right.
and play a role in there. Also, here's a law. I don't know if you've noticed this before, but there is actually a law in the Old Testament law that says when a man marries a woman, he has to take a year off of his service to mm-hmm. make his wife happy.
That's right. I like that law.
Not even to make himself happy with his wife, to make his wife happy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not a less than... relationship. Look at the relationship in Song of Solomon. It's not a less than relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that guy's really taken with her.
Yeah, and she gets equal time in the book to give her feelings. She's not an object. She's not like a piece of property to him. We just don't see that. Again, I think a lot of people making these accusations are not very familiar with the Old Testament.
There's a difference, too, with ancient Near Eastern cultural practices and what Scripture kind of represents. So you have this backdrop of ancient Near Eastern cultural practices in which women were second-class citizens, and even Jews sometimes treated them that way. But when you look at the record itself, the biblical record, the inspired record, what you see is a reporting of these noble women who did great things.
Mm-hmm.
Consequently, were not backwoods, secondary kind of people.
And another one that comes to mind is Hannah, I think that's in 1 Samuel. And
Samuel's
Her husband is very concerned about her and says, aren't I better than, she hasn't had any children, so she's very sad about that.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, aren't I better to you than 10 sons?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that he's not treating her like property.
Right.
There are a lot of tender moments between men and women.
And then when she has a baby, she gives him away.
Yeah.
Samuel.
Yeah.
He goes off.
That always amazes me.
She sends him off to the temple. She weans him, of course.
No, she gives him to God's service. She doesn't just hand him off to a random person.
Right,
if anyone's not familiar with that story.
Right. I'm making a joke, but it was,
And of course, he becomes
the great prophet of the Old Testament, Samuel, and anoints David as king. Saul is king and David is king.
So I have a post on the website at str.org. I think it's called something about did Old Testament men treat women like property or something. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I have a few things listed there. So if anyone's interested in more on that, I first recommend reading the Old Testament. And then,
Well, you had all of these people handy. It sounds like you've been doing some thinking about this.
Well, obviously people asked me about
but it was great.
Women. So.
It was great.
All right. Well, thank you, Greg. That's
You're
it
welcome.
For today. And thanks, everyone, for listening. We look forward to hearing from you on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.